WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, streaming live and available on demand at WBAI.org. Coming up next, Good Morning Nueva York, with me, your host, King Downing. Good morning.
You know how I feel.
How are you this morning? Welcome to Good Morning Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We'll be here till 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is engineering in studio. If you're just waking up, rise and shine with us. If you're already up, stay with us. If you're one of the many overnight and essential workers just getting home, let us tuck you in. It's a new day, new week. New decade, get it done in 21. We opened up with a song called Attica State. It's actually from a Pilates album. And as I was looking up Attica music, because that's our topic for today, I found this one. Quite a contrast to what we're going to be talking about later. And then, of course, our theme song, Feeling Good, by Andy Bay and the Bay Sisters. On today's program, part two, we remember the Attica prison rebellion at 50 years through a documentary, the voice of an Attica survivor, from an anniversary program, and we'll hear tapes of a phone call between U.S. President Nixon and Governor Rockefeller, who ordered the assault on the prison. In the second half of the program, we also remember the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attack by looking at the media's role in the drumbeat towards the wars that followed. So stay with us. We're going to get on with the program right now. Welcome to Good Morning Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We'll be here till 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is engineering in studio. 50 years ago yesterday, on September 13th, the Attica prison rebellion came to a brutal and violent end. We're going to remember that anniversary today through a documentary, through the voice of an Attica survivor from an anniversary program, and we'll also hear tapes of a phone call between President Nixon and Governor Rockefeller. Governor Rockefeller ordered the assault on the prison. So we're going to start off with a clip from the 1974 documentary Attica. And this is available at Maisel Cinema as part of a program of virtual free films about Attica that will be playing until September 20th. So let's take a listen to excerpts from Attica.
All right, that last squad.
Right, there you were. Well, hey. I go right around to the supply truck and pick up the shotguns and rifles.
On the double, let's go.
Get them back in there.
So keep there. Keep
the
left.
You bring the gun for the bullets? Well, what's more important? The lives of these people or the retaking of this institution? This institution is not important. It's lives that we're interested in, Ed. What's more important?
Let the people in the world, let us know what you feel about this. We want to hear from you. We want some support from y'all.
And if we cannot live as people, then we will at least try to die like men.
Nobody takes a weapon from you.
You're to meet force with force. There have been some of the prison personnel severely injured here this morning. And we certainly don't want to see any of our people hurt.
Any longer would not only jeopardize innocent lives, but would threaten the security of the entire correctional system of this state. Armed rebellion of the type we have faced threatens the destruction of our free society. We cannot permit that destruction to happen.
At that point, the decision was made. There was no alternative but to go in. I supported that decision, and as chief executive officer, I'm responsible for what happened to this day.
Hear all the people screaming, and like at first they thought that they were shooting rubber bullets, and all these people started getting up and you'd see them getting blown apart.
The helicopter flew over and they told everybody to surrender. Guys put their hands on their heads, and when they said it's the second time, they just opened up shooting. I got my leg shot off. The state trooper walks over to me and says, you won't rebel no more, will you, nigga? And hit me in the leg with the gun butt, the one that was shot off. So the guy says, well, let's kill him. So the other guy says, we're not going to kill him. He's going to bleed to death. The guys have got their shot in the head. Some guys got their head, pieces of their head shot off in the chest, you know.
On the whole, man, this guy's just laying all over, man. It was like a battlefield. Guys were just laying all over, man. They were like, they were shot all up, man, you know. And they was trying to give up there, some of them. And they were just shot down, just like that.
I seen a bunch of people that's supposed to be human beings just shoot like they're shooting wild animals in a jungle. Cold-blooded surrender with his hand on his head, but he'd still be exposed to being killed.
I heard a guy holler out, you know, like, please don't kill me, don't kill me, don't kill me. And the guy told him to shut up. So he said, don't kill me. They kept repeating. He said, I said, shut up, the shot rang out, and I didn't hear this guy no more.
You know, no tears in my heart. My heart bleeds for all those brothers, man, you know. I've seen it, man. I've been to the fire. I've seen it.
Our objective was to reach them as rapidly as possible and protect them.
Well, was there anything in your plan that would have protected the hostages in the circle of the yard, which is where they were on Sunday, if the inmates there were determined to cut their throats?
In the event that we didn't reach them in time?
Well, you couldn't have reached them in 5 or 10 seconds that it would take to slit a throat.
No, that's what I'm getting at. In other words, I just want to clarify your question.
Sure.
Are you asking, were there any plans to do anything about the hostages if we were not able to affect our mission and surround them?
No, what I'm asking really is whether there was any way that your plan could have saved lives of the hostages if the inmates were determined to cut their throats.
Oh, I doubt it.
Dunbar stated that the reason that Oswald gave the order to come in and shoot and killing people was because he personally saw an officer having his throat cut. He says he watched this officer I was told, Kurt, he said, and he was really, really terrified by this, you know. And he said he also saw in the process an officer being emasculated. This was the incentive for coming in and killing everybody.
Now, all the days before the assault and during the day of the assault, we as responsible newsmen depended on the word of the commissioner of the State Department of Corrections. Mm-hmm. He came out here repeatedly at the height of the most dramatic moment that has ever happened in the state of New York, mm-hmm. and repeatedly gave us what we were led to understand was factual information, mm-hmm. information we now question front to back. What? We ask him to give us the courtesy of responding to those questions. Give us some answers. Short of that, he's frightened and scared.
What information did he give you that was inaccurate?
He told us
about the slashing throats.
And I want to especially criticize the news media, which accepted as true, without any reservation, without using the word alleged, the statements of the prison authorities and the governor, that the men, the hostages, had had their throat cuts, that one had been emasculated, and that two had been killed long before the onslaught by the state troopers. You did everyone a disservice in accepting that fact. You did everyone a disservice and might have caused additional tragedy in reporting as fact what now has proved to be lies. And I think in the future, you should judge your own consciences in how you report statements of public officials without any opportunity of the outside world to verify them.
The press was eager to get out a story. More eager to get out a story than to investigate the story they were getting out. They wanted to say, well, we'll get the scoop here. We'll get it to the readers quick. But they wasn't concerned with the authenticity of it.
What hostage was killed by his throat being cut? Name one. None. All of them was killed by bullets, gun wounds, shotguns, M16s and whatnot. So now after they recognized that they bullets had killed the people, now what they gonna do? They gonna dupe the people and tell the people that their throat was cut. That's the reason they told the lies. They had to justify their wrongdoing.
Okay, but
seven.
You said
7 out of 9.
I'm sorry.
The impression.
We all heard it. I think if you go back over your tape, you'll find out. Right. I said several. I understand.
But the point is, there were none.
The forensic pathologist who did the examinations reported that the cause of death in each instance was gunshot wound.
And even after they found it was wrong, they didn't put in their papers that, okay, we found we were wrong. They didn't do that. They just didn't speak about it at all. Like, okay, so we made it. But however, if it was proven, and it has been proven, if they were wrong, they should have reprinted an apology. You know, to their readers, they told them a lot, you know. Not only that, I would go one step further. They should put an apology to us. Okay, how can you apologize to a dead man?
And we commit his body to the ground, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
If Rockefeller had taken your father's advice, what do you think would be the situation today?
Well, I think that most likely my father would be alive right now, and that was more or less the big wheel's fault for giving the state troopers the order to attack him.
Did you have any communication with the governor prior to September 13?
Prior to?
Yes.
No, sir.
And when you asked prior to, did you have a communication afterward?
Yes, sir.
What was that communication?
Telephone.
And what was the nature of the conversation?
He spoke to me.
And when he spoke to you and thanked you?
Yes, sir.
I imagine that they would have come then, you know, with the nightsticks and so forth. They would have taken over the prison and retaken the prison. But I had never expected them to start shooting like that.
And then they had a PA system saying, place your hands on your head and surrender to the nearest officer and you won't be harmed. And they kept shooting people when they said that. They said they shot people, right?
It was a slaughter line, man. It was people were defenseless. All right, they had sticks and homemade weapons to defend themselves, but this doesn't compare, man, with magnums and carbines. Well, this is ridiculous.
They call it indiscriminate firing. I call it plain, outright, premeditated murder.
We're on the roof of C Block, looking at a detail of 270 marksmen
with instructions to clear the catwalks upon command.
Six.
And the ball would be thrown forward, which would be arming the weapon, so to speak. One round in the chamber. To fire the weapon would be brought up, sighted through, sweep up around.
And would that be approximately the speed at which a qualified 270 man can fire, Mr. Little? Were you qualified as a 270 man?
Yes, I was. And depending on what you would be shooting at, a stationary or a moving target, and whether you were resting or whether you were firing offhand. But that's the speed that I would probably fire the weapon if I were hunting.
And what was the position in which people were firing this? Were they kneeling?
Yes, they were kneeling over a parapet in this fashion, looking down into the yard.
I was laying perfectly still, more or less like playing possum, and these bullet slugs kept exploding right near my head, but I didn't dare move. And I noticed every time one would hit the ground in front of me with mushrooms, so I knew they were shooting these hollow nose bullets. And I didn't know at the time what caliber or anything, but I know it was popularly known as dum-dums.
Well, I was hitting my left side with what they call dum-dums, you know, but I passed out in the cell, you know, from loss of blood and internal bleeding. And they took all kind of x-rays and said they couldn't remove the bullet, you know. It was too close to vital spots and, you know, due to the type of bullet, I guess, you know. You know, I'm constantly in pain. I guess I have to live in the rest of my life, you know. That's what they're telling me, you know.
As you can see, the projectile, as it leaves the weapon upon impact, begins to, and it is designed to, expand inside the body of the game animal. Target animal. Pursuant to the Geneva conferences, to prevent, insofar as is possible in war, unnecessary human suffering, United States military personnel are prohibited from use of this kind of ammunition in combat.
And after we were taking the A block there, we were there for our guys, we were required to run the gauntlet, you know. They got officers on both sides, you know. And we were required to run that where they had the belts and the buckles and everything out there was like whamming them, you know. A lot of guys got broken limbs on account of that.
I saw lines of uniformed correction officers on either side of the corridor swinging their clubs and striking the males who were running through there.
So I was in charge of the litter team, so I just picked the first door. As we got into the reception center, and as I walked in, I got the door a quarter of a way or halfway open, and I saw correction officers bending over, beating on somebody that was on the floor. And they told me to shut the door, that I wasn't allowed into that room.
Did you receive any reports that day of any acts of mistreatment of inmates?
No, sir, I did not.
But basically, they were in the position of having surrendered, hands on head, were coming down and were very forcefully being forced down the steps, were forced to lie down and low crawl across there. Apparently, the method employed to get them to lie down was to hit them with a club across the knees, or in several instances, not too disguised attempts to hit them in the genitalia was made. Injury was done to prisoners at that point by the violence with which they were forced to lie on the ground and crawl across.
The most frightening part about the whole thing was when they'd moved everybody into A block yard, like, and had us on our faces laying down, and it, like, I was trying to look up and look around at what they were doing, and a policeman came over and he put the shotgun barrel right against my head and told me to bury my nose in the mud, and he kept the gun barrel against my head for about a good 5 minutes, just stood right there with the gun barrel pressed into my skull, you know. I was crying then because I was really afraid that they were going to pull the trigger because I'd seen him shoot a couple other people.
There had accumulated a group of persons just at the door leading from D to A. These were people who had not been there previously. They were ones who had bullet wounds or, in one instance, a fractured leg. This man I saw get his fractured leg. He was coming down the steps and was hit across his tibial area, which is the forefront of his leg.
Who, when you say you saw him hit by what kind of personnel?
They were primarily prison guards themselves.
Were they calling them names? Or
yes,
what were they saying?
I hesitate to use
in such language. I think we've had this language here, if you can. Accompany, there were racial epithets. The classic Anglo-Saxonism of F-U-C-K was used in multiple times. The basic tenor of the thing was, you sons of bitches had your week last week, this week is going to be our week.
Boots, they smashed everything.
I was taken out of the yard, and I was put on a table, nude, laying on the table with my head looking up at the catwalk being spit on, hot shells thrown on my body, cigarettes thrown on my testicles. They had a football under my throat. I am looking up at a shotgun, and if it fall from under my chin, I would be killed. My body, at present, have cigar burns, cigarette burns, all over it. My testicles, at times, bother me now from cigarette butts, sticks, rifles.
And you're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City, streaming live and available on demand at WBAI.org. The program is Good Morning Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We'll be here till 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is engineering in studio. We are continuing today part two of our remembrance of the Attica State Prison Rebellion 50 years ago. We are now going to turn to the voice of one of those who was there at the time, and this is Jorge Che Nieves. Let's take a listen.
You know, early in the morning, about 8:30, close to 9 o'clock, outside of the prison, all the guards and the state troopers were armed to the teeth. They were armed. They were ready. They had more guns than people. And that's real. They had more guns than people, and they were ready to come in and kill. Monica, I will tell you that I heard these guards saying, it's white power time. It's white power time. I heard them. They were saying, niggas must die. Niggas must die, you know? And of course, I understand why, because most of the people whom they came in to kill was us, people of color. You know, they came in with that intention. Before I went to the war, they put an X on my back. An X was a sign of killing. It was death automatically. They told me to put my head on the wall and put my arms against the wall. And so that's what I did. And, a few moments later, I think it was a sergeant. He came and he stopped at me and he said, who do you want us to contact? So I looked at him and I said, you gonna kill me? And he said, who do you want us to contact? And that was it. Meanwhile, there was a state trooper sitting in the back of us with a rifle, ready to shoot us. After the whole shooting stopped, L.D. Barkley was singled out to be killed. Tom Hicks, another brother, was singled out to be killed. You know, Sam Melville was singled out to be killed. Them bullets that they had had names on them.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be driven or beaten as such. The entire prison populace has set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed.
The legacy of Attica will always be a reminder to all of us who are fighting for human rights and freedom, who are fighting for a new society free of racism, abuses, exploitation, and inhumane treatment. A society whose prime interest is the people, who loves the people, and a society that is not capitalist orientated. But the legacy of Attica is resistance. And that's the legacy that Attica left us, you know, that we need to fight. That the only way we're going to maintain our freedom is by fighting. The only way we're going to gain any rights in this country is by fighting. Power to all the people, power to all prisoners, free all our political prisoners.
And that's the voice of Jorge Che Nieves. Next, we're going to turn to tapes from the time between U.S. President Richard Nixon and Governor Rockefeller after the brutal retaking of Attica Prison. Let's take a listen.
I have Governor Rockefeller for you, sir. There you are.
Mr. President, I know you've had a hard day, but I want you to know that I just back you to the hilt. And I was sitting here talking to Bob Haldeman. I didn't get your call because I've had a cabinet meeting, and then I had a meeting with business leaders right afterwards, and I've been just got out. But the courage you showed and the judgment in not granting amnesty, it was right, and I don't care what the hell the papers or anybody else says. I don't care what they say. I think that you had to do it that way, because if you would have granted amnesty in this case, it would have meant that you would have had prisons in an uproar all over this country.
That's right.
And you did the right thing. It's a tragedy that these poor fellows are shot, but I just want you to know that's my view, and I pulled the troops around here there to back that right to the hilt.
Well, aren't you great, Mr. President? I only called you because I wanted to alert you that we were going in, and
right. When
we went in, we couldn't tell whether all 39 hostages would be killed and maybe 200 or 300 prisoners.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty big, you know.
Yeah.
But the way it worked out, there were about 1,200 prisoners. By taking and putting down a gas attack from helicopters, and then having sharpshooters on the walls, our own men, we were able to pick off, either from the wall or as our men went in, the men who had the knives at the throat of the hostages, and they did a fabulous job.
How many? I only got the report this morning. What is the latest report? How many people?
Seven hostages were killed.
Seven hostages were killed.
These were the guards.
Those are guards, seven.
It appears now, Mr. President, as though quite a few of those were killed prior to this. In other words, that they'd been dead.
Uh-huh. You can prove that, can't you? I mean,
this is the hospital.
The hospital can prove that.
Oh, yeah.
They can find out how long guys dead.
That's right. And it's a Catholic hospital, so it's outside of our jurisdiction.
Right. How many prisoners were killed?
32.
32 prisoners killed.
32 prisoners, although we've just found, in the last 10 minutes I got word, two Puerto Rican prisoners who were tucked away in a tunnel who had their throats slit 4 days ago.
Oh, geez.
So that we're developing all kinds of...
Tell me this. Are these primarily blacks that you're dealing with?
Oh, yes. The whole thing was led by the blacks.
I'll be darned. Are all the prisoners that were killed blacks? Are there any whites?
I haven't got that report, but I have to... I would say, just offhand, yes.
Yeah.
We did it, though, only when they were in the process of murdering the guards or when they were attacking our people as they came in to get the guards.
You had to do it.
And otherwise, we recaptured all the cell blocks and so forth without shooting a shot. And no troopers were wounded. One of them was in the leg. But
only one trooper was wounded. Good.
That's right.
Good.
It really was
good.
A beautiful operation.
Well, they must have really been... You can certainly tell your people there, whoever they are, your head of troopers, that I have great admiration for that. That's an efficient operation.
That's wonderful of you.
Well, we back them up. Now, by golly, we're not going to have any we just cannot tolerate this kind of anarchy.
They were putting the pressure yesterday on me all day to go up there. Ended up, because everything else had failed. And
did you go?
Of course not.
No,
I wouldn't.
Of course not.
But I had to talk to these guys, Wicker and all these people on the phone, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, look, I go up there. We can't give amnesty. The next thing is, well, we'll let them go if you'll just come into the courtyard.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
In front of all the men.
Well, did Wicker, was he recommending amnesty?
Oh, yes.
Oh, God.
Oh, you listen. This separated the sheep from the goats.
Oh boy! Oh boy! What is your what is your the New Democrats going to say about this? Mr. Lindsay.
You mean our police officer?
No.
Lindsay. Oh, brother, we should worry.
The convert.
Oh, he'll probably say that if I'd gone up, all these deaths would have been saved.
No, sir.
But I noticed he didn't go into the prison when they had the problem down here.
No.
But well, I think it was tough, but I think we did the right thing, and we...
You did.
4 days of negotiating.
Yeah.
So everybody had a chance.
That's right. Well, you handled it well. Your people handled it well. But I want you to know that down here, I'm gonna get a few people with some backbone to stand up on this thing because I think it's coming.
We got a little problem of identification as to how the people were killed. And now it looks as though there's some question as to some of them weren't shot by the troopers.
Oh.
Well, you know, this is one of those things. You can't have sharpshooters picking off the prisoners when the hostages are there with them at a distance with tear gas without maybe having a few accidents.
Oh, sure. You mean...
In that case, it might be that some of them were shot by the guards, but that's life. They saved a lot of them. I didn't think we'd get any of them.
Well, you saved a lot of the guards.
32 of them got out. Or
that's what I mean.
So
that was worth it.
There you have the voice of President Nixon congratulating Rockefeller on the brutal assault. And you heard Rockefeller cleaning up his act, having to admit that it was the troopers and the sharpshooters who killed the hostages. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is DJ Baby K from The Sweet Spot. On the go, but want to support the station dedicated to you, the listener? No problem. Simply dial 41444 and text TRANSMIT 995 to make a pledge by text. Support WBAI's unique voice and keep us on the air during this critical time. Once again, dial 41444 and text TRANSMIT 995 to make your pledge. Thanks for supporting listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM.
Welcome back to Good Morning Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We'll be here till 7 a.m. Michael G. Haskins is engineering in studio. And in the background, war. And we've been talking about wars. We were talking about the war against the incarcerated people at Attica 50 years ago. And now we're going to turn to 9/11. This is the 20th anniversary of the attack. And we're going to be looking at the media's role in the drumbeat toward the wars that followed and the effect that has had on the rest of media relations and the inability of the truth to somehow reach the people. We're going to get right into that. And the first thing that we're going to be listening to is some clips from Shadows of Liberty. And this is a documentary that you can find online at no charge. Let's take a listen to Shadows of Liberty.
This is the mother of all scandals. International finance, nuclear weapons, spying. And yet, New York Times, Washington Post, AP, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, all of them apparently couldn't give a damn about this story.
In the wake of 9/11, the media focused its attention on terrorism.
The wars that
threat of nuclear weapons falling into the hands of terrorists is real. Should we
this is
be
scary
worried?
For people. The idea that a terrorist or a criminal enterprise could come up with a nuclear weapon or even a dirty bomb.
This was about 4 or 5 days after the September 11 terrorist attack when the FBI was asking people with language abilities to join the Bureau.
Sybil Edmonds would have been listening to evidence of criminal activity, corruption issues. The FBI was also looking at proliferation of nuclear materials, weapons transfers, weapons sales that were illegal.
One of the investigations by the FBI led toward Turkish groups involved in nuclear espionage.
What I was reviewing was not only in foreign language, a lot of them, in fact, were in English. It involved people from the State Department talking to the targets of these operations.
What Edmonds allegedly heard were conversations about the exchange of U.S. nuclear secrets between a Turkish group and Mark Grossman, a high-ranking State Department official.
Mark Grossman's conversation with the Turks was very definitely against U.S. interests. It also was a crime, because there were other conversations indicating that he had taken money from the Turks. So that is a clear issue of corruption in the U.S. government.
Edmonds discovered the alleged illegal sale of U.S. nuclear secrets.
She's talking about stolen secrets sold on the black market to, frankly, enemies of the U.S. Iran, Libya, North Korea, potentially even Al-Qaeda. This is happening in the highest level of the U.S. government.
When she reported her discovery to the heads of the FBI, their reaction was unexpected.
The assistant director of the FBI coming and boldly asking not to report this any further, that this was explosive, and just asking me to forget and move on.
When she continued to raise questions at the FBI, Edmonds was fired with no explanation.
So you're firing me without providing me with any reasons? And the response was, no, we're not firing you, we're terminating you. There's a big difference.
She took the FBI to court for wrongful termination, and the administration responded by silencing her under law.
This absurd state secrets privilege is absolute, and it requires no evidence.
At that point, I thought there will be no judge who would agree with this. I mean, this is ludicrous. Instead, the judges asked the security to come and escort me and my attorneys outside the court, and never got to hear the argument. Everything about this case is considered classified, highly sensitive, covered by the state secrets privilege, me including my name. In effect, I became this classified woman.
Edmonds turned to the media to report her exclusive story of alleged government corruption.
Sybil Edmonds, in a heartbeat, could have been scooped up, thrown in jail, and never heard from again. So it took, you know, no small bit of courage for her to come forward to try to get her story out.
I did not receive a single inquiry from the mainstream media here.
While the mainstream media remained silent, she received support from Daniel Ellsberg. Decades earlier, the press had published classified information he'd obtained revealing government corruption surrounding the Vietnam War.
Nixon's fear that I had more information to give led him to take a number of criminal actions to shut me up. This country needs whistleblowers like Sybil Edmonds if we're to hold these officials accountable.
I put her in touch with a couple of people. In each case, there was great excitement in what she had to say at the reporter level. They pursued it for a while. She had great discussion with them. And then suddenly, there would be an abrupt cutoff.
Her story made headlines around the world, but was not echoed in the mainstream press in the United States.
There are many examples where a story is huge all over the world, except in the United States. Even if they're reported, they don't hit the media echo chamber. And stories don't have much impact unless they get into the echo chamber.
What happens is that people call up some of the top newspapers, get them off the story, and having done that, the other papers follow the lead of silence.
We are going to see less and less of whistleblowers because each example set, like myself, is a lesson learned for those people who may be planning to come and do the right thing.
To this day, no mainstream news organization in the United States has investigated Edmund's claim of nuclear espionage by American officials.
Who's actually doing the censoring? Is it the media themselves? Is it the government? I don't know. But if it didn't appear in the New York Times, Washington Post, AP, it never happened.
This country wasn't set up to have a government of, by, and for media conglomerates. Democracy needs those diverse, competing voices. The consolidation of media has robbed us of that diversity. In many cases, we have no voices. Whole areas of government and politics and power going dark.
In 2007, with the FCC reviewing its media ownership rules, the public came forward.
Millions of people wrote to Congress, wrote to the FCC, emailed, spoke out at forums. You'd have a forum of 1,000 people. This was unheard of, saying no. One media mogul can't own the radio, television, and newspaper in a city.
Here was an example where the public had intervened and gummed something up.
Under new chairman Kevin Martin, the FCC announced public hearings on media ownership in cities across the U.S.
We are some of the most entertaining people on the planet, but we don't know a lot about what's going on in the world because of the way our children see them.
Four companies control 86% of Portland's media markets. That is not diverse. It is not competitive. Certainly not what we need.
Look around. We are concerned citizens. We're trying to believe that we matter. Don't make fools of us.
Our culture is being criminalized by the radio station. Beg the FCC to help us.
We don't have news anymore. It's all entertainment.
On every channel, you can switch from channel to channel and see the same thing.
NBC, CBS, ABC, and Fox do not serve the people.
That's consolidated media.
All you have is the same 10-song playlist, whether you're in New York, Oklahoma.
Certain channels spend more time on plastic surgery than the war in Iraq.
So some Wizard of Oz tells us what is news.
The States of America may as well be called the United Corporations of America.
It's very clear that this country has become profits over people.
Despite overwhelming public opinion against more consolidation, Kevin Martin sided with the media conglomerates and removed the cross-ownership ban.
The public hearings were more a dog and pony show than an actual opportunity to see if this was something that the public wanted.
What Kevin Martin did was demonstrate his absolute thoroughgoing contempt for doing his job and representing the public interest, embracing entirely the interest of wealthy corporate benefactors, period, pure and simple.
The international commerce got bigger and bigger. The view began to prevail. What's the big deal about news? What's all this talk about public service? Baloney. We're in the entertainment business.
As TV networks chased profits, NBC News sought to exploit the internet by blurring the line between news and entertainment.
Anyone watching this scene repeat itself over and over might be wondering what's going on.
NBC's Catch a Predator was ostensibly a news program, and when they saw that it was a ratings winner, they really began to push it and produce more and more and more of these shows that really blur the line between reality television and news department. And it's really sort of car wreck television.
You ask if she can do Deep Throat.
Explain that to me.
NBC launched To Catch a Predator, a news program featuring undercover sting operations that exposed men seeking sex with minors.
NBC came into the area. They selected a house. And in that house, they set up computers, they set up cameras, basically set up a stage in which they could lure a criminal to over an internet.
In the autumn of 2006, with the help of local police, NBC News set up one of its undercover stings in a small town in Texas.
The kinds of places they choose are smaller police departments who don't have the resources to mount these kind of very ambitious sting operations. But for the fact of NBC News, police wouldn't be there. There wouldn't be any arrests. There wouldn't be any police officers taking down these suspects.
NBC had contracted an actor who was at the time either 21 or 22 years old, but he looked much younger. And his photo had been used as this guy who had presented himself as a 13-year-old boy.
With a new Dateline nut crime to catch.
The program lured 20 men to the sting house. But NBC News really only had one man in mind.
When they discovered that they had an assistant district attorney on the hook, that there was a real sense of excitement. This was going to be good for the show.
Bill was always the egghead in the firm that knew the answer to every question. And Bill was scary bright. He loved his parents and loved his family, and that and his law practice were the two pinnacles of importance in his life.
They had tried very aggressively to get him to come. They kept urging him to come. Why aren't you coming over? Things like that.
To the disappointment of NBC News, Conrad never showed up at the sting house.
It's the final day of shooting, and Luke still hasn't managed to get Bill Conrad to actually show up at the decoy house.
With the NBC News deadline looming, the show did something it had never done before.
Ultimately, in order to get to Bill Conrad, they decided to basically bring the show to him.
Mr. Hansen appeared to be in charge. He would ask for things, and he was immediately accommodated.
It certainly looked like a case where the cops were doing what they were doing as agents of a television company.
NBC News and the police waited in front of Conrad's house for hours, hoping to confront him on camera.
He was at the office every day like clockwork. They could have just come, tapped him on the shoulder, and taken him in. This was all done as part of a need to get it on film for a television show.
With Conrad staying put, police broke with procedure and called in a SWAT team with NBC News cameras rolling.
They forced their way into the house. They encountered Mr. Conrad in a hallway holding a handgun, at which point he raised the gun and shot himself in the head and killed himself.
What can you tell us about the scene?
It's just a gunshot wound to the head.
There's nothing wrong with a sting operation. There's nothing wrong with taking criminals off the street, provided you're doing it for the right reason. If you're luring them there because you want a television show, well, then you're wrong.
The way these folks pulled off their maneuver and shocked and startled Bill Conrad, they could have handled it with so much more dignity. You'll never convince me that that was a service to our community.
Well, I sat down and talked with Chris Hansen following Mr. Conrad's suicide. He was not overly apologetic about what had happened. In fact, he said, "I sleep well at night."
NBC News broadcast the program during prime time, despite Conrad's death.
The American public knows far more information about sex scandals, celebrities, Hollywood, than they know about economics and the environment. That's by design. I think the people that own the media would be much happier if we were a nation of mindless consumers rather than a nation of informed, active citizens.
To seize this moment, we have to ensure free and full exchange of information. And that starts with an open internet. I will take a backseat to no one in my commitment to network neutrality. Because once providers start to privilege...
It's simple, it's net neutrality, it's non-discrimination, and it's a basic principle that politicians pay lip service to it. that if these same players like AT&T, Comcast, and Time Warner are able to take over the internet through lax public policy, that we'll lose even the internet.
Despite his election promises, President Obama has brought in new internet pricing rules going against the principles of a free and open internet.
It is by making publishing cheap that permits many more people to become publishers, that permits many more different voices. But that's where the internet has really excelled. WikiLeaks has published a lot of information about war, about militaries, how they behave, intelligence organizations. And that information often comes as a surprise to the public. It's because the public has been lied to.
Come on, fire!
We have moved the envelope for what is acceptable for people to publish.
Should the United States do something to stop Mr. Assange?
We're looking at that right now.
Mitch McConnell says he's a high-tech terrorist. Others say this is akin to the Pentagon Papers. What do you come
to? I would argue that it's closer to being a high-tech terrorist than the Pentagon Papers.
The greatest fight we have had in bringing the First Amendment to the world was in bringing the First Amendment to the United States.
This guy's a traitor, a treasonous, and he has broken every law in the United States. The guy ought to
be... The question is, what's going to happen now? Will the internet remain free? Or will a few companies be able to control and monetize it? That's the debate of the era.
If we are to address the most fundamental issues of the 21st century, we have to stop, recognize that our media is in crisis, and ask ourselves, what is the media that we want?
We want more information, access to more information. We have fewer people who will control the information.
Can't allow this country to go down for the count because some guys on Wall Street can't make money producing garbage news.
The media is that kind of issue where if we want it to be better, we have to fight for it.
These are the critical battles we face right now in the United States and frankly in countries around the world. How we respond to this moment will be every bit as definitional as how the founders responded to their moment.
This is really about having a conversation about what kind of decisions we want made in our name. That's really what will save us, is when we really know what's going on, not filtered through the lens or the microphone of a corporation.
And if somebody wants to comment on all of this, either Attica or 911 or anything else, we have time for a quick call. If somebody wants to call in and make a comment, you can call 212-209-2877. 212-209-287 on the WBAI member and WBAI buddy listener line, people who have pledged by going to give to WBAI.org and made a donation to the station. So I'm going to tell you where you can find this information while we're waiting to see if anybody calls in. So the Attica film is part of an entire series that's being held virtually and free at Maisel's Cinema, Community Cinema House, Documentary Cinema House, Maisels.org. And you can see Attica and the other films from now through September 20th. There are six of them all together. A great, great collection of information and visual information about Attica. The excerpts that we were listening to about 9/11 and this was, I hope, a take that you enjoyed about the way the media contributed to all of this and how we can expect that to happen as other issues continue to rise. That is called Shadows of Liberty, and you can find that on the online as well at no cost. Last call for folks to call in. Last call. If not, we'll tell you goodbye. You've been listening to Good Morning Nueva York. I'm your host, King Downing. We've been here since 7 a.m. Thanks to Michael G. Haskins for engineering in studio. And I will be, we have a call. Let's do this really quickly. Caller, briefly, tell us your name, where you're calling from, and what's your comment.
Hi, good morning. This is Adam. I'm calling from Floral Park in Queens. My comment is regarding the sharing of information as it regards to the science behind the vaccines, and that one thing that not a lot of people are talking about is the financial conflicts of interest between the researchers and the corporations, and that in some industries within science and within medicine, that the industry, such as, say, the mental health field or the GMOs, it's pervasive with dual affiliations of researchers that do the actual research and also work for the corporation. And I think that people would question everything about what we're being told, and that if they don't question whether we've been told everything before concerning 9/11, concerning other events, they should be questioning that now, because it would be an investigation on a global scale. Thank you.
Great, great, great last-minute comment. We're going to have to close out there. Thank you for calling in, Adam. As I was saying earlier, I will not be on tomorrow. We have a special program for you, but I will be back Thursday with more. Thanks for listening, and have a great day. You know how I feel. Breeze drifting by. You know how I feel. It's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's a new life for me. Feeling good. Fish in the sea. You know how I feel. River running free. You know how I feel. Blossom on the tree. You know how I feel. It's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's a new life.
Uppers had in common, these were people who were unable to sit out a historic cataclysm.
And if you look at footage from United in Anger of a Monday night meeting where there'd be 300 to 700 people at the Gay Center, you can see that it's mostly white gay men. But when you look at the work that people did, when they left that Monday night meeting, people were working in coalition with all kinds of communities and all kinds of organizations. There were people working with drug users and fighting for needle exchange, and there were people fighting for housing for homeless people. There were people working for incarcerated people with HIV. There were people working with mothers who were HIV positive.
Tune to Out FM from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday, September 14th. For a two-hour fundraising special on the history of the direct action AIDS group, ACT UP, on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
are tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI, WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next, what's going on with your host, Frenchie Davis.